KEZH 910 AM, W245 CT Hayward, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Richard Cantu. Declaring the war on women's sports is over, President Trump issued an order barring trans women from women's sports.
President Trump before the cameras and a cheering crowd in the East Room, signing an executive order banning transgender women and girls from competing in women's sports. The head of the NCAA said, of the approximately 510,000 college athletes in this country, fewer than 10 are known to be transgender. And tonight, advocacy groups fear this move will only lead to more discrimination and harassment.
ABC's Rachel Scott. Legal rulings starting to stack up against Trump's bid to end birthright citizenship. A second federal judge, this one in Maryland, issued a preliminary injunction against the order. Earlier, a federal judge in Washington State blocked it. He beat and suffocated to death a pastor in his own Arlington, Texas church in 2011. Stephen Lawayne Nelson got a lethal injection in Texas on Wednesday. This is ABC News.
I'm James Kelly with WBZH News. Your news roundup in quick podcast form. Find it anytime on the WBZH website at buzzofthenorth.com.
The Bucks make a deal. Hi, I'm Jimmy Cusco with sports. Milwaukee is sending Chris Middleton to Washington. The Bucks are trading Middleton and A.J. Johnson to the Wizards in exchange for Kyle Kuzma and Wisconsin native Patrick Baldwin Jr., as well as a second-round draft pick. A pick swap was also included in the deal. Middleton, a three-time All-Star, helped the Bucks win the 2021 NBA title. He signed a three-year, $93 million contract before last season. The NBA trade deadline is tomorrow afternoon. The Bucks take on the Charlotte Hornets tonight with a tip time of 6 p.m. The WIAA has approved a change to its high school football playoff qualification process. The Board of Control voted this morning to create a wins-based metric for teams to get into the postseason. The new setup will also seed teams in the playoffs, eliminating the need for computer algorithms or coaches voting. In addition, the WIAA also expanded the 8-player football playoff field to 32 teams and moved the start of the season up 1 week to match the start of 11-player football. With Civic Media Sports, I'm Jimmy Cusca.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
Thomas Crapper Day, the guy that invented the toilet, and that's why they call it the crapper. This guy created a legendary device, the turlet,
yep.
And we rewarded him by naming said turds after this guy's last name. That wasn't the case for Phil Orgasm. That didn't stick. But for whatever reason, Tom Crapper, this is your day. Rejoice. We'll all have one in your honor.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba. Weeknights from 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. This is the Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. I had thought of, you know, ticking off all of the Elon Musk's attacks, you know, like doing away with the federal government helping, you know, fill out the EZ form, having that available, or Marco Rubio taking over USAID, or any of the infringements on our government by the corporate class, by the billionaire class. And it just dawned on me that, you know, just ticking that stuff off, you know, is hard to grasp, when the reality is this is what oligarch government looks like. It's chaotic because they don't want to actually govern. They don't want your lives to get better. They don't want things to get better. They don't want government to work. We have people who don't believe in government running government. And what you see, the chaos, the sausage making chaos, is all about getting you to turn away. And the number of people who've reached out to me and said, you know, it's been a long 2 weeks. And it has for a lot of people. It's been a long bit of time. That's the point. This is what destruction looks like. They're not about building something better. It's about tearing something down. My grandfather always used to say, you know, any idiot with a hammer can tear down a house. It takes a skilled craftsman to build one. We don't have skilled craftspeople running our government right now. We've got destroyers. And when you put destroyers in charge of things, they do what destroyers do. They destroy. But in the process, it's rob and pillage. And we don't know how much. And look, I said at the very beginning, this will be the most corrupt administration in the history of our country by far. The kleptocracy that is going to be our federal government, if we're allowed to look back at this period of time, will be staggering. Our great-great-grandchildren will look back and go, wow, you got taken. Because when you have a government of, for, and by the billionaire class, the oligarchs, if you will, that's been the new buzzword. If you have a government that serves their particular interest, it doesn't matter if it fails. You know, this idea that, you know, Trump is going to recreate the federal bureaucracy into a legitimate functioning government, an efficient government where there's no waste, fraud, and abuse, and Elon Musk goes in there and whittles out all the fat like we're told they're doing. Understand, that's not the inevitable goal. It's about destruction. It's about, and understand, destruction is the reason. It's the point. It's the reason they're doing it. Because the only entity that can hold the billionaire class in check is government. And they know this. The only one that can tax them out of existence is government. You know, the other day we had Matthias Vernengo on, professor of economics at Bucknell, who made the very real comment that said, you know, you go back to the robber baron era of the 1880s, 1890s, which we hear a lot about now as the golden age of America. You know, when robber barons didn't have to hide their wealth or be ashamed of it, they could flaunt it in the face of those poor, hungry children. They want to go back to the good old days, where they can steal with impunity and leave nothing left of a government that can hold them in check. Now, you get into the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s. We didn't have the robber barons of that era because we taxed them out of existence, basically. And if there's ever been a poster child to return to a 92% tax rate, like it was under FDR, like it was under Harry Truman, like it was all the way up to Dwight David Eisenhower, and actually up into John F. Kennedy, who dropped it down to 70%. If there's ever been a poster child for a 92% tax rate, it is Elon freaking Musk and all of his little muskrats who are ferreting through our government, grabbing up all the data they can possibly gobble up, not because they care about efficiency, it's because they're figuring out how to profit off of it, how they make Musk the first trillionaire at your expense and mine. And for me, when I look at the response from Democrats, and look, Hakeem Jeffries came out with a 10-point plan about how they're going to, you know, fight against, you know, ending Medicaid, and they're gonna you know, go after, you know, a fiscal system that, you know, the Treasury Department's fiscal system payments, and defend that, defend people's ability to have confidential, you know, personal information related to Social Security and Medicare, you know, all okay. There's a whole plan. And it's all about highlighting the horrible that's going to happen in front of us, what they're going to do, and trying, if they can, to choke some of it off. And we'll see. To this point, Republicans have shown no courage. They are all lackeys for Trump, and they will do what they're told, which is not good for working people. Across the board, not good. What I want people to understand is, you know, and what I've been, where my mind has been, this is going to happen. We're going to get ripped off. But we have to keep our eyes open. We have to stay alert and awake and aware, because, again, the solutions will come out of the savagery. As they're stealing, as they're robbing and pillaging, as they're gutting Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid, and they're doing all the things on their wet dream list, it's our job. It's our job to pay attention, remember, and then when we have the chance, throw these bums so far out. And Democrats, you need to have a plan of, hey, how are we going to take advantage when they overreach? What's the vision for the future? That's where my mindset's at. I want to hear your thoughts. What are you paying attention to? How bad do you think it's going to get? Email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Quick break. When we come back, Scott Paul is going to be here from the Alliance for American Manufacturing.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, here we are, a day after all of the hot takes on Trump's tariff talks. And look, you know, I said on the program that my concern for using this tool is that he's going to screw things up so badly that we'll never use tariffs again. That was my hot take of the moment. And it looks like maybe got something. We don't know all the details. I'm not quite sure how this is all going to play. But in true Trumpian fashion, he is touting this, and his sycophants are touting this as, well, the greatest deal ever. Mr. Art of the Deal has done it again. And again, devil in the details, I want to see the rest of it. But here to share some thoughts on, well, where we are, what this was, and maybe how it's going to affect China. I've asked my good friend Scott Paul to come share some thoughts. Scott is the president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, AmericanManufacturing.org, the website, if you want to check out their work. Scott, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick, great to be with you.
So what were your thoughts on the rollout of the proposed tariffs, and any thoughts on how this has played out?
Well, look, I mean, there's a lot of stuff. I guess I have a lot of thoughts on it, but I think the most important ones are, you know, this is what he initially said he was going to do, right? He said he was going to do the tariffs on China and Mexico and Canada related to fentanyl and immigration. And so puts the executive in order into place, but also extracts concessions, no surprise, I think, from Canada and Mexico. Some of those, I think we could politely call restated concessions, and declares victory, postpones those tariffs for 30 days. And at least as of when we're recording this, the tariffs with China, the 10% tariffs, are going to move forward. What I worry about is that, you know, I learned a lot from the first Trump administration about how to respond and how not to respond to things, and how to take things and how to look at the strategy. I don't know that a lot of other people did, based on what I saw over the last 72 hours or so. And it is like a tried and true tactic of his to walk right up to the line, to actually sign something, to put something into motion, and then to, again, extract a concession. And maybe it's a new concession, maybe it's a restated concession, and then delay something. Now, this happened, with China and with steel and aluminum, in the first administration. There ended up being tariffs on steel and aluminum, a couple months after the threat was initially made. And so when people ask me, I'm like, look, you know, the hour-to-hour whiplash of this is going to drive everybody crazy. And unfortunately, there's a lot of people who, you know, were saying, you know, your avocados are going to cost more for the Super Bowl and your pizza is going to cost more and this and that. And I'm like, you know what? Let's just wait to see what actually happens here before we're going to go out and gun this. And I guess, Rick, the last thing that worries me, and this is not just about the some of the Democrats' approach to this, but just the media as well, is that I do think that in a lot of communities in our country, there is a massive amount of concern about the impact that fentanyl has had. Okay. And, you know, how it's contributed to overdose deaths. And it is true that the amount of fentanyl coming in is coming down, but by 20%. But that's still a massive amount coming in. And it's, and we also know this from polling that people have concerns about immigration. And so, you know, I do think that people who are criticizing the tariff approach also need to have a plan to how to address this stuff that is real and speaks to those concerns, because I do think that those are tangible issues that people in a lot of communities care about. And in particular, let's not lose sight of this, working class people and working class communities as well.
No, it's where we went on the show yesterday, where I said, look, you know, I don't want to ruin this tool. And Democrats had better come up with a message to talk to working people. And I think just what you laid out.
Yeah. Yeah. And I want to come back, because you're right. I mean, the overuse of this threat potentially erodes it as a tool, whether it's to fight unfair trade practices, to try to seek reciprocity, or to rebalance trade relationships as a punitive measure, or to gain other policy wins that are important. So whatever it is, the more one does this, I think you're absolutely right about this, that you may end up increasing the number of opponents and critics on the use of tariffs, the legitimate use of tariffs, as a policy tool. Now, I do think, I will say this, I think it is perfectly legitimate to utilize tariffs for national security reasons. Okay, I do. I mean, there's some people who might not think that's the case, but I definitely do.
I'm one of them.
Yeah, think that that's the case. And so, you know, what one president thinks is national security may be slightly different than what another president thinks is national security. But I do think that the escalation of all of this doesn't do favors for anybody else. And at the core of this, and I'm just going to say this, I don't know that in the case of Canada and Mexico, that Trump has any personal affinity for Claudia Sheinbaum or for Justin Trudeau. In fact, quite the opposite. I don't think he likes them.
Right.
And I think there's a degree of that complicates things. And that's, you know, there's nothing I can do about that. I'm just stating the fact is that we're kind of, you know, we have this kind of like we've been dealt these cards that aren't great towards having amicable relationships because of the personality clashes between the leaders in the country. And that's going to continue to complicate, I think, a lot of issues.
And I guess the question that I have on the other side of this is, how many times are we going to go to this well then? Because it looks like this was just a bargaining tactic, of which I've had conversations with people in the past about a friend of mine who used to be a USFL labor attorney. And he tells the story of how Trump came into the negotiation, just blew everything up, and then gave away the baby in the bathwater and basically screwed all the other owners. But he walked out for himself with a pretty good deal. So for me in this, I kind of see this as his MO, that, you know, for you, me, working people don't care. You know, how does this benefit him? And it's the message. It's the the message that came out of it. And I'm wondering how many times we'll go to this kind of a well before people call him on it.
Yeah, well, and that, again, that is a real question, because there are a lot of serious trade challenges ahead. And the most cogent piece of work that the administration has done on trade was the executive memo that he signed on the first day. And it was like, and I think we went through this, like there's 23 different things. I think you and I would be concerned about virtually all of these, right? The trade deficit or reciprocity or unfair trade practices or currency manipulation or the de minimis loophole. And the list goes on and on and on. And so all of these are legitimate reasons why one could put tariffs on products if you don't get an arrangement that's helpful for working people. But again, I'm going to go back to the response here. I think that I think that critics of this, and in particular Democrats who represent working class constituencies, need to be very careful, you know, not to be, you know, echoing the talking points of, God forbid, like the Cato Institute, yeah, who doesn't agree with them,
yeah,
on anything, or the Chamber of Commerce. I mean, you're if you're retweeting the Cato Institute or the Chamber of Commerce, and you're a Democrat who says you're for working people, there's a disconnect there, right? You got to do a little better than that.
You better do a little research. Maybe I'm just throwing that out there. But no, look, we had a friend of ours on the program Monday night, Emily De La Brea. She was on talking about how this would affect China, and how, because I was curious what her take on it was. And she said, look, if this is a way to leverage, you know, Canada and Mexico into, you know, holding China in check, if this is a way to get Europe to do the same thing, if this is a way that we can, you know, bring the world together on the China issue, then maybe this is a good thing. And I think we both agreed, or it was my position, I'm not going to put words in her mouth since she's not here, is that I don't think this administration has that kind of strategic thinking, because Trump hasn't shown me that in the past. So I guess I'll throw it out to you. Is that part of what maybe we might be seeing or not?
Wow. That's a great question, because quite honestly, that's what was really missing from Trump's first trade policy. I mean, Lighthizer hit a lot of notes during that first term, and they did a lot of good. But, you know, creating a coalition to stand up to China wasn't necessarily one of those, right? And who did that? Joe Biden actually did that with the Europeans and the Canadians, who brought trade cases against China. And so, look, we'll see if that continues. And there's another motivation here that we haven't touched on. And this to me, I haven't figured out. I'm going to be very candid about that. You know, these guys want to do big tax cuts that cost a lot of money to extend, and they're looking for spending cuts, and they're looking for revenue offsets. And there's a lot of fans of using tariff revenue as a source to offset the cost of some of those tax cuts. And so it's interesting to me, every time he makes this threat, you know, and then pulls it away, that's not revenue that they're utilizing. And so I guess they can use some of the 10% on China as long as that comes in. But I'm also wondering, like, how that is gonna frame the conversation for this administration moving ahead, and whether they view tariffs as a viable source of revenue to offset tax cuts, sure, for the wealthy and for corporations.
And I mean, so if you put it out that way, basically, because tariffs do raise the cost of things a little bit, not the kind of simplistic math that...
That's right. They potentially raise the cost, and they can raise costs for consumers.
Sure.
That is true.
Yep.
Yeah.
And so we're gonna stick it to the little guy so that we can, again, redistribute wealth upward. That's what you're telling me, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, if it depends on how these things are structured, and if the tariffs are on a lot of consumer goods, and, you know, folks are going to, and those are going to be 100% passed on by these corporations, who, by the way, are getting a big tax break, so they don't have to actually pass those those costs along if they don't want to. But yeah, that is the potential. And I'm not sure, you know, I've looked at the history of tariffs and how much revenue they raised. And, you know, it used to be the way we got most of our revenue in this country up until the late 1800s, right? And then when we got an income tax. So,
right, and this is where I was going with this.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I hear a lot of that kind of, we need to go back to when America was great, you know, the 1880s, 1890s, that robber baron era, where the Elon Musks of the world were not the, you know, weren't the outlier. There were some of them back then. You know, we had our robber barons of that era, and then we lived through the hellscape that was, you know, the depression of the of that era, and then ultimately the depression in the 30s, to where we said, no more. No more of these rich people. And, you know, name me a, you know, a 1950s, you know, billionaire. We got rid of a lot of them, or they went underground. Now we got a guy who's ferreted so deep into our government, he's got the checkbook. How an unelected Elon Musk got the checkbook, I don't know.
Look, the dude's smart. That's how, right? And he has a, you know, he has a willing patron, right? You know, and so I would like to see the United States to become a manufacturing powerhouse again.
Yes.
The way to do that is not to say I want to be William McKinley. Okay, that's not the way to do it. You got to take a dash of Lincoln. You got to take a dash of Teddy, of FDR, even a little bit of Eisenhower. Honestly, interstate highway system, a little bit of the space. You know, you got to blend all of that together, and then you can come up with it. But a Gilded Age, reincarnation for the 21st century, is not going to do that. So it takes a much more sophisticated strategy.
So last question I've got for you, or last line of questioning on this, and again, this is just an opinion thing. It's easy to bully our allies. It's easy to go after Mexico. It's easy to go after Canada, even though we have a free trade agreement with them. China's a whole nother story.
Yeah.
I don't know that they roll over in the same way. I think they're feeling very muscular, especially now that they're, you know, a little bit further down the road. Does the talk of, you know, taking over Greenland, does the talk of imposing more tariffs, does that make this, that heighten this trade war that everyone was talking about? Or do you see this just as another day of doing horse trading?
Yeah, well, if you're an international observer of this, or you're in China, I do think that you have to look at some of the territorial and other ambitions and take those pretty seriously, because there is going to be fierce resource competition, right? I mean, there's no question about that, particularly for the resources that are going to drive energy and drive transportation, mobility, and everything else in the future. So that is going to be out there. Now, yeah, China, it's interesting because militarily growing a bit, the economy is a shambles right now. Right. The growth has slowed down. They have a demographic problem. They are a little less trade exposed to the United States than they were 7 or 8 years ago, in part because of the tariffs and then moving investments to other countries. They would, in some ways, they wouldn't take as a direct trade hit, but they're also maybe a little more economically sensitive. Because they've had to kind of build any economic growth on just like manufacturing stuff that people don't want, right? Yeah. You know, over the industrial overcapacity, they've run out of tricks, right? They've tried real estate, they've tried infrastructure, and now they're going back to just making a lot of stuff, and it hadn't worked particularly well. So it's going to be interesting to see how measured the response. I saw China's going to say they'll take a case to the WTO. Good. You know, fine. I mean, the WTO will say, yeah, this is wrong, and then it'll get appealed, and there's no appellate body, so nothing will ever happen, right? And so if China actually takes a real step and does something, and then we're talking. We'll see what happens there, Rick.
I do find it interesting that they're going to go to the WTO to take us there. And I brought this up on Monday. I do find that's cute.
Yeah, it's cute, considering – and we're in the 25th year of China's accession to the WTO. And throughout all of that, no one has obliterated the rules of the WTO more than China has. And so it's basically them steamrolling all over all of this that has rendered it just irrelevant, basically. Now, and so, you know, no one takes it seriously.
Now, you said steamroll. You know, I have listeners who are going, look, we're competing. There's a competition here. You don't have problems competing with other countries. Why are you regurgitating neoliberal talking points against China? Thoughts on the competition with China thing?
Yeah, absolutely. Again, I think that each nation has a right towards their own internal development and to build up their economy. I think that when it spills over and actively hurts workers and other, you know, other facets of economies and societies, then you have to push back. And that's what China does. I mean, the United States, when we were trying to invest in our own clean energy manufacturing, we were making the pie larger, right? We wanted a bigger slice of it, but we were making the pie larger for everybody. That's not what China does. China has a pie that this big, and they just want increasingly more of it. They want to dominate it.
Yeah.
And that makes it harder for all of us. That's the fundamental difference. And that's why we have to push back.
There you go. Scott, as always, great stuff. I look forward to talking to you again next week.
Likewise, Rick. Thanks so much for having me on. Appreciate it.
Scott Paul, president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, AmericanManufacturing.org, the website. I agree with him 100%. We need to become a manufacturing country again. I would love to be able to look at that bridge in Trenton, New Jersey that says Trenton makes the world takes again. I would love that across the country, that to be reality. I want to hear your thoughts. Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Right back.
You're listening to WBZH, Hayward's home for the Todd Allbaugh Show.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Cloudy with snow showers for tonight, 2 to 4 inches by dawn. Temps drop back into the low 20s, and readings fall into the teens for tomorrow afternoon, especially as the wind picks up, gusts 30 to 40 miles an hour. Sunny in upper teens Friday. Currently, it's 17 degrees.
The Maggie Dawn Show.
Open that conversation with this person that you disagree with so much by trying to find the shared value, the thing that you both actually agree about. Challenge yourself to keep bringing it back to the value that we agree on and maybe even the outcome that we wish to see. Go have the tough conversation, because you know what gets better with practice? Those tough conversations.
The Maggie Dawn Show. Weekdays from 2 till 4 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So as you know, I've been spending a lot of time dealing with a healthcare system. I'm not even sure I'm going to call it healthcare anymore, but the hospital system, the doctors, the nurses, all of that. And it got me thinking a lot about who's going to be overseeing our health system. The person that Trump has nominated to be the head of Health and Human Services and all of the wide array of things that agency does. And when I look at someone like RFK Jr., I just I don't get that warm, fuzzy feeling. Maybe it's because I don't have a brain worm. Maybe it's because I am not a former heroin addict. I'm not sure, but here to share some thoughts on maybe why I should embrace RFK Jr. or maybe not. Maybe my gut reaction is accurate. I've asked Jill Rosenthal to come share some thoughts. She's the director of the Public Health Policy Program there at the Center for American Progress. Jill, thanks for taking time for us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
So is my gut reaction right? Should I repel the idea that RFK Jr. is going to be someone I want in that position, or we as working people are he's someone we should want or is he someone we should be very afraid of?
I think your gut is right on here, Rick. He is not for the American people. He would be a deadly choice to run Health and Human Services as secretary. And there are a number of reasons that we could talk about. I think, you know, the one that is probably he's most known for is conspiracy theories. And we can't have someone running this federal agency who does not believe in science.
Right.
And you could go through all kinds of conspiracy theories that he promotes. Many of them have to do with vaccines. It's very well debunked that vaccines do not cause autism. There is lots of data on that. He has other theories about HIV does not cause AIDS, or he has said that, chemicals in the water can cause kids to become transgender. All kinds of things that are clearly, you know, the science does not support. And when you have someone in a powerful position who is telling people or sowing doubt in the public, then, you know, it makes it harder for people to know what the right thing to do is. And if we don't do the right things, for instance, vaccinating our kids, we're going to be putting their safety at risk. And we do not want that. So we cannot have someone in this position who, you know, cares more about their own personal opinions than about what the research says. So that's one reason. There right. are many others.
No, there are. But, you know, you brought up the big one for me personally. Back in 2002, my oldest daughter was born, and I was drawn in by his anti-vax kind of discussion, this idea that Timerosal causes autism, Timerosal's in all of these vaccines, and, you know, be afraid, because, you know, my wife and I were older parents. She had what was known as a geriatric pregnancy at like 35. Which is weird. Or no, at that point, she was of advanced maternal age. The next two were geriatric pregnancies at 40 years old. But I bought into it. You know, I actually went to our pediatrician and I said, hey, look, I'm really worried about this because there's this guy that, you know, was a member of Congress. You know, I gave him some credibility. And my doctor, she sat me down and she's like, hold on. And she walked me through, and fortunately, I trusted her, and I've had a good relationship with her. So she talked me off the ledge. But a lot of people aren't that fortunate to have a pediatrician that they trust and that they had a good relationship with. And I know people who were sucked in by it because we want to do what's in the best interest of our children. So for me, right off the gate, you lost me, RFK Jr., with that nonsense because it wasn't accurate.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's reasonable to have doubts. Like you're saying, you want to do the best for your kids. And if you're hearing people telling you things like that in powerful positions, it's hard to know. So that's what people should be doing, is talking with their doctors and having conversations. And, you know, it's not for someone in this position to be refuting the evidence that has been around for a long time. So he's citing, you know, reports that are not reviewed by peer review scientists. They've been clearly debunked. And, you know, the research is very clear that vaccines save lives. They've saved a million lives just in the past three decades. And that's not only saving lives, but preventing hospitalizations, and it's saving money. And, you know, that's about $1 trillion that those vaccines have saved by preventing those diseases. So it's preventing hospitalizations. It's preventing special education for kids who, you know, suffer from diseases. It's preventing parents having to take time off from work to care for sick children. So, you know, we need to do what's best for our kids. And clearly the evidence shows it is these vaccinations that prevent routine childhood illnesses. So, yeah. You know, you just look at the data, look at polio as, you know, a great example, or measles, where, you know, was basically eradicated until lately, you know.
We're going to make that great again. We're going to make polio great again. Rest assured. But you said a moment ago something that caught my ear. We're making it harder to know what's going on. And I think that's the goal in all this. That you put someone like RFK Jr. into that position, and it's hard to know if it's conspiracy, if it's actual science, and you're giving him the credibility of that office to say, you know, I've done my research. And if there's anything that came out of the pandemic that I hate more than I've done my research, I haven't found it, because do your own research is not watching a YouTube video with your mouth open sitting on the can. That's not actual research. But in the RFK Jr. world, that kind of passes for it.
Well, and, you know, if you watched the hearing, you know, Senator Cassidy, who's a physician, really, you know, tried very hard to get RFK to, you know, he was trying to help him, I think, in a way. You know, this is your chance. This is your chance to say that vaccines don't cause autism. And RFK couldn't do it.
Right.
And, you know, RFK has a stake, a financial stake in some of the lawsuits against vaccine manufacturers. So again, we can't have someone in this position who has a financial stake in people not following good science and good medicine.
Now, the other part of this is, look, I do look at people's personal lives, and I'm sad to hear that RFK Jr. struggled with drug addiction and has whatever the brain worm is. But there are some things that make you go, I don't know. Is this somebody we want in that position? I've had people saying, look, he's overcome it. This is, maybe a feather in his cap. I'm not leaning in that direction. Does that matter to you?
Well, it doesn't matter to me if he had issues with substance use and he received treatment and he has recovered. It does matter if he doesn't support evidence-based treatment for substance use disorder. And he's a little waffly there as well. We know that there are medications that can help folks who suffer from opioid use disorder. He's talked about wanting to make wellness farms available for people to go recover. Now, what exactly is that? I don't know. I mean, we know there are a lot of therapies that can help, but we know that they're addictive drugs and that these medications can help folks recover. So, again, I worry about, is he going to follow the evidence, or is he going to continue to spout conspiracy theories and look to profit off of them? So that's what I find most upsetting and disturbing. And I think he's talking about cutting some of the agencies that he would be in charge of. So, for instance, the Food and Drug Administration. They're inspecting our food. They're making sure our drugs are safe. He's talked about cutting the National Institutes of Health. They're doing research into identifying causes of disease and finding cures and treatments for people that have disease. So, we should be making sure that those agencies are working effectively and efficiently and not, looking to make them ineffective.
But, I look at his nomination as the culmination of decades of right-wing extremism, the Alex Joneses of the world pushing these supplements and this alternative medicine and all of these things. And they're having their own little incestuous pool of research that they pull from each other to make their points. And look, they've done a really good job of creating their own universe of information, not peer reviewed, not in the world that I think, scientists of any note or any credibility would notice as or recognize as something reputable. But they have kind of created this world to where the average person, who got out of high school science class barely, who is, looking for an expert to say, hey, this is okay. My concern is by putting him in this place, you give that kookery a whole lot of credibility. And it sets us back as a country in believing in actual science instead of pseudoscience.
Absolutely. I mean, I couldn't say that better. That's exactly the concern. So if he's out talking about stuff that's nonsense and he's in a powerful position, people don't know what to believe. And we are at a point where, we need to encourage people to trust in science, trust in medicine, trust in public health interventions that keep people healthy and safe. And, we can't have people in powerful positions threatening, sowing distrust and threatening our health. I mean, I think, he's touting theories about fluoride and, that's in our water. It's keeping our teeth healthy. And in fact, oral health or oral tooth decay is the leading cause of chronic disease in children. So why would we want to take something out of the water that's protecting our teeth? Or, same thing with drinking milk that isn't pasteurized. We have a risk now of bird flu, and we know that, it's important to pasteurize milk to be healthy. So we can't afford to have someone in this position who is going to threaten our health.
And, yeah, but and Jill, I know a lot of people who do drink raw milk. I won't do it, but I know people who, that's my choice. I think they should be allowed to do that. You know, you want to do what comes after that? That's up to you. Are we opposed to that idea?
Well, again, this is an area where the evidence tells us that it's safer to pasteurize milk.
No, we agree. I agree with you 100%. That's why I don't do this. But there are other people who go, look, you know, for hundreds of years, people lived on farms. They drank it right from the tap.
Yeah. I mean, I hear what you're saying. I think the big concern right now is that we have bird flu. And, you know, we have seen that, you know, bird flu is in cattle. It is in milk. It is, you know, cats have gotten bird flu from drinking cow's milk. So we're on the cusp of a dangerous situation here. And, you know, the evidence is showing us that this would not be the time where that's the healthiest choice to make.
No, and I agree 100% with you. I'm on board. Is it contagious? I mean, if some idiot wants to drink the milk, get bird flu or whatever comes of that, I'm okay with it. You run your path, brother. As long as it doesn't affect me, is there a way that that actually then affects me by that person being able to do whatever they want to do? God bless you. You know, drink gasoline if you want, for all I care. Is there a way that that affects me and us as a society?
Well, in that particular case right now, no, it is not. But there is a fear that if someone gets bird flu and they also have regular flu at the same time, that though they can mix and then become a new kind of virus that could then become contagious. So I think this is one of the issues that's really important, is that we tend to think we should be able to do what we want to our own bodies, but we forget what the implications are for the people around us. And that's the same thing with vaccines, you know, in terms of, you know, you look at measles, it's really important that we have community immunity. So if we get our vaccine levels to a certain level, it protects people who are immunocompromised, people who can't get vaccinated.
Right.
So, you know, we tend to think, oh, it's all about, you know, me and I can do what I want. But you know, there's a community responsibility, I think, to keep other people health and safe.
No, that's where I wanted to go. That's what I wanted to get to. I wanted to know ultimately, how does it affect me? I don't want those problems. I don't think as a society we should want those problems, and we should be armed with the information of going, yeah, you have the right, as Justice Black said, you have the right to flail your fists around until it touches the tip of my nose. That's where it touches the tip of my nose. So thank you for that. And I've had a bunch of people ask me, is there anything I agree with RFK Jr. on? And I've said, yeah, I think our food supply is a little over manipulated. I know in Europe they have much different standards. I have friends who live there. They say things are much different. You know, the chemicals that we use, you know, I'm not 100% on his side, but I do see that as a problem. Is that something you might agree with him on, or is he taking that to a kook direction too?
I would agree. And I think many people would agree that we have too many unnatural substances in our food, and that we would be better off finding ways to produce our food in healthier ways. I think the proof is in the pudding in terms of what strategies he would use and how far he would take that. And I think that is not clear yet. You know, I think he also makes a good point about the fact that we spend too much on healthcare. So, we don't get the results we should for what we put into our healthcare system. And, you know, his wanting to emphasize and focus on reducing chronic disease is, I think many people would agree with that, but we need to do it in an evidence-informed way. And that's where we end up. You know, you can agree on the problem, but not the strategy to solve it.
I know, and that's where the rubber meets the road. And ultimately, I'm hoping he does. I come at this from two directions. There's the person who wants good outcomes, who cares about society, who cares about the direction of the country and my neighbors and my family and all that. I don't want him confirmed on that base. Then there's the part of me who sits in this chair and goes, chaos is good for ratings, and death and destruction and pain and misery that I do believe his tenure would cause. That's the only way we learn our lesson is the hard way, then he would be the best person for that job.
Yeah, I'm going to hope that's not true, because I'm right where I said at the beginning. I think he would be a deadly choice, and I'm going to hope we don't go in that direction and that we look for a healthier way forward.
So last question, any chance you see this nomination going forward? Any chance, not going forward, but being confirmed, do you think the Republicans are going to throw him all their votes? We'll see.
I'm going to go hopeful that I think there's a few folks that are very concerned about some of his conspiracy theories and the fact that he does not seem willing to learn, that he's stuck with his own opinions and he won't learn from the evidence. So I'm going to say,
there you go.
I'm crossing my fingers and hoping for the best.
Well, we will see. And if and when it happens, whichever this way goes, I'd love to have you back again to either go, we made the right choice, and talk about the next person, or prepare us for the hellscape of healthcare that we're going to see in the near future. But Jill, I appreciate you taking some time for us, sharing your thoughts. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you, Rick.
Jill Rosenthal, the director there of, I'm sorry, director of public health policy at the Center for American Progress. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Anything you agree with RFK Jr.? You think he's going to get nominated? You think he's going to get confirmed? I want to hear it. Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1913. That was the day that Ida Bremen was killed while she stood up for the rights of working people in Rochester, New York. Ida was born in Russia to a Jewish family. She came to the United States fleeing persecution in her homeland. Her family came to Rochester because it was a thriving center of the U.S. garment industry. Seeking a better life, Ida's father joined the Brotherhood of Tailors. In January, garment workers in New York City had gone out on strike. Factory owners in the Big Apple decided to send work to Rochester in an effort to avoid the striking workers. Unions were forbidden in the Rochester garment industry. Union leaders from New York City came to Rochester, asking them to stand up against the factory owners. The workers in Rochester agreed to support the strike, but they wanted union recognition, the 8-hour day, and a pay raise. Ida and her father were among the first to walk off the job. Ida joined picketers in front of a sweatshop on Clifford Street. The picketers were there to protest the shop's workers who were not taking part in the strike. The shop owner, Valentine Sauter, fired a rifle into the crowd of picketers. Ida was struck by the boss's bullet and killed. She was only 18 years old. That night, she was supposed to have her engagement party. The community was outraged. 5,000 people attended her funeral. Mass rallies were held across the area. While no one was ever held accountable for her death, Ida's murder became a rallying cry for the striking workers. They continued to fight until April, when they won the right to join a union.
Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in Two.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Can't get wellness farms out of my head. I just can't. I can't get it out of my head. Re-education camps? That's the first thought were my wellness farms. That's an upgrade. Never mind. This is where we're going. And look, unions are on the front line of the defense, which is why Republicans have wanted to destroy them for decades. Why the push to go after labor unions when you're talking about in the private sector, right around 6% of employees overall, less than 10% of the entire U.S. workforce are members of labor unions. So why are Republicans so hell-bent fixated on their destruction? Well, I think on Monday you saw Public Citizens Litigation Group and the State Democracy Defenders Fund, along with the Alliance for Retired Americans and a couple of labor unions, the American Federation of Government Employees and the Service Employees International Union, SEIU and AFGE, they filed a lawsuit on Monday against the Treasury Department for sharing confidential information with the Doge boy, with Elon Musk and the muskrats who have been ferreting around in our government. And understand, nothing good can come of Doge boy and his cabal having the kind of unfettered access that we're being told they have, allowing him to slash and burn and cut things. And I know there are going to be more lawsuits down the road. I know that's coming. And look, this is a great one as well, but they're still doing this stuff. And for the short term, they're getting away with it. And how much pain and suffering and all of that are they causing? Understand, the Treasury Department has lots of sensitive personal information, lots of financial information on all of us. And, you know, there are federal laws in place to protect that data. Evidently, Doge boy doesn't have to abide by that. Now, my problem is I look at him, I look at Musk as someone who, he's the richest guy in the world. Here's a guy who probably wants to be a trillionaire. Who wants to be a trillionaire? And I look at this and I go, do we want this guy who, as I said the other day, Tesla's not a car company. Tesla's a technology company that makes cars. They're a data company. That's their stock and trade. Data is the gold of this era. And Elon Musk struck the gold mine when you're talking about the federal government and all the information that they have on all of us. And I liked what Rich Fiesta said. Rich Fiesta is the executive director of the Alliance for Retired Americans. They represent some 4.4 million members nationwide. These are retirees, seniors who, you know, living on a fixed income. Rich said, you know, we're outraged and alarmed that the Trump administration has allowed so-called Doge staff to violate the law and access millions of older Americans' sensitive personal and financial data. Now he goes on to say, look, seniors are already the most vulnerable Americans to fraud and scams, with FBI data showing losses of $3.4 billion in 2023 alone. Rich says, we urge the court to quickly act to stop this unlawful theft of our data. And it was that. Now, look, you know, Everett Kelly, the national president of AFGE, said AFGE, you know, proud to partner with all these, standing up for the privacy rights of American citizens, including those we represent in the federal government. You expect him to say that. And, you know, look, he's doing the right thing. But Rich's take on this, that, look, scam artists, con men, you know, Doge boy and the orange Mussolini, they've got a history. There's a history there of interesting dealings. And to give that kind of information, have unfettered access to everyone's data, that puts seniors at risk of being taken advantage of. That puts people at risk of being taken advantage of. And understand, now they have potentially a clear picture of, let's just take, you know, privatizing Medicare, of who is still on traditional Medicare and now who you have to go after, target lists. This is, and I know, Rick, you sound paranoid. No. If I can think of this, if a dumb truck driver can go, hey, there's a lot of uses for that data, what can a guy who thinks he's the smartest guy in the world ever, what could he dream up? What kind of financial ripoff schemes can he come up with? And all of the people around him that, again, fashion themselves as little muskrats, what could they come up with? And I started thinking about all of the seniors that I know and, you know, what this could mean to them. To have a whole new line of con men at their door, calling them in the middle of the day, emailing, all of the, just with personal data. Now, remember, most of the time you go, oh, you don't know what you're talking about. But someone calls and tells you your social security number. I don't know, man. I want to hear your thoughts. Am I going too far? Are you afraid of Musk and his little muskrats running around in our federal database? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. As always, thanks for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. At rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
This is the Buzz of the North, WBZH 910 AM, W245 CT Hayward, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Richard Cantu. Trump administration officials trying to ease fear amongst some FBI agents amidst the call for a review of thousands of personnel who investigated January 6th.
The acting deputy attorney general sending a letter calling for calm amid fears of mass firings, writing, "Let me be clear, no FBI employee who simply followed orders and carried out their duties in an ethical manner with respect to January 6th investigations is at risk of termination or other penalties. Warning, only agents who acted with corrupt or partisan intent in those investigations should be concerned."
ABC's Rachel Scott. In a Wednesday night filing, the Justice Department agreed to a proposed order largely preventing the Treasury Department from sharing sensitive financial data with the private government efficiency.